Good to see y'all. I hope you had a nice holiday. It's a sort of a silly song, but a very serious text that we're going to look at today. I am, as many of you know, not someone who teaches directly to the moment, so to speak. I don't usually talk about current affairs when I'm teaching Torah, current events. But I not because I don't think the Torah speaks to the current moment, but because I think that the Torah is cannot be contained by the current moment, is infinite and therefore speaks to every moment. But of course, we are meant to apply the Torah to the current moment. I don't mean to say that it lives in a detached spiritual reality, but we all apply it differently, and so I'm always a little nervous about applying it directly. I'm nervous about my interpretations and nervous about other people's interpretations, because we try our best, but we don't really know how exactly to apply it. So I want today, for all of that, I think I've developed a certain nervousness around teaching with any trace of like political awareness, and that's probably an overcorrection. So I want to just name that I am the piece of Torah that I want to look at with you all today is certainly one that I that evokes for me the current moment of conflict in Israel and Gaza, and one that I've thought about a lot. I'm not going to talk about Israel and Gaza, and I don't really want you to either. That is to say, at least not in a direct way, just because we will all have different ways of interpreting this image. It's a very disturbing, very disgusting image, as a matter of fact. But I think it's one that and I will just say it could be applied in all kinds of ways. So this isn't a secret pro-Israel, pro-Palestine Torah, it's not, but I think it's an important image for us to be reflecting on. And so we're going to try to understand the image on its own, and I hope that it will be helpful in some way for thinking about, well, for thinking about not just this conflict, but thinking about what it means to live in that particular piece of land, and all the people who want to. So we'll start with just a prayer for peace for that land and all the people in it, and we'll say a blessing, and then we'll take a look at this very, very strange image, a very strange image. That appears in this week's Parsha, Parshat Achrei. We are coming off of Passover, and so we're back in Leviticus, Parshat Achrei. And as usual, I wrote a piece on it for Hadar. You could take a look at that. But we're going to be doing something different today. So let's take a break just to say a blessing. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech haolam asher kidshanu b'mitzvotah v'tzivanu la'asok b'divrei Torah. Thanking God for the Torah, and the space to really sink deep into the Torah, to go all the way deep in before we are ready to come out and start applying. Okay, so here's the scene. Here's the story. Here's the image. We're gonna get it right up front, and the song, the silly song, at the beginning, alluded to it. But Parshat Achrei begins by detailing the Yom Kippur service, the two goats. That's what I wrote about this week, and that's just a fascinating, endlessly fascinating a ceremony. But then there's a break. We're talking about chapter 17 now in the book of Leviticus, and this is where academics often start naming what is to follow the holiness code, Because from chapter 17 on through 18, 19, 20, maybe 21, 22, for several chapters, it's laws. And that's, it's not that the rituals of Leviticus so far have not been laws, mitzvot, so to speak, but they're mitzvot for the temple, for the priests, for the altar. And now we start getting laws of all kinds. And next week is really like the famous section. Parshat Kedoshim is like, that's the heart of the holiness code. And it it begins with this injunction, Kedoshim to you, to be holy. And presumably all of the laws that follow are ways to be holy. But that's already, as the academic designation indicates, that's already been happening since chapter 17 here in the middle of Parshat Achrimot. So what's happening now? What's going on? How are we suddenly turning into law? And I think now it will be helpful to read the passage and to look at the image to get a sense of what laws and what prohibitions in particular we start with. And one of the words that that the Torah uses to categorize the initial prohibitions is toeva, which is an abomination. We'll talk in a sec about what that means and what kind of laws that that alludes to. You probably, even in our kind of King James, you know, fashioned ear, now abomination has certain connotations. It's used in certain ways, weaponized maybe in certain ways also. So we're not going to go all the way there, but it will be relevant. So let's take a look here. Let's see. Okay. Okay. This is a source sheet for you. And very quickly, we'll have the image that I want to spend our time, you know, I guess the word is like meditating. I want to meditate on this image today and then hopefully come out of that meditation with a little more awareness. So let's take a look here. Here is the source sheet. And we're starting now we're in chapter 18, and I'm going to, I've noted the word toeva or abomination, and I will speak kind of retrospectively about which toevot have been mentioned. But let's just first take a look at the image, which will be the focus of our class today. And here it is. Okay. Do not defile yourself. Al titma'u. There's that language of sometimes impurity or sometimes defilement, uncleanness. But as we always say, there's no perfect translation for it. So don't make tamei yourself. Don't make yourself defiled or tamei b'chol eile in all of these ways, which we'll soon talk about what those waves might be. B'chol eile nitma'u agoyim asher ani mishalech mipneichem, because those ways, the ways that I'm that I am telling you not to defile yourself with, those are precisely the things we've seen happen here before. And of course, this already is an important binary to keep track of: what we do, what others do, the other nations are their behavior, our behavior. Okay. Vatitma ha'aretz. Now here is the, I just named a couple of players. Us, Israel, other nations, the goyim, literally not the literal meaning, the other nations. God is obviously speaking, so God is in the mix. And now there is another character, and this character seems to have an identity of its own or an ability of its own to become Tamei v'titma ha'aretz. Thus the land became defiled. V'titma ha'aretz. The land itself became defiled. V'efkod avona aleha. And I called it to account for its sin. Although it's a little bit funny. Like, does the land sin? That's funny. But here, the possessive pronoun, I guess I would say, of the hay is the land's sin. I called the land account for its sin. And here's our image. Here's our word. Here's our phrase for the day. V'taki ha'aretz et yoshveha. And the land, and here we'll soon translate it, but here's one of the translations. The land disgorged its inhabitants. Okay. Another translation that I saw was spewed out its inhabitants. Okay. If you know modern Hebrew, you already know the taki, how that could be translated, but let's just read to the end. You must keep my laws and rules. Ushmartem atem et chukotai vet mishpatai. These are some of the laws and rules that we've been talking about. Velotasu mikol ha-toevo ta'ele. And don't do any of these abhorrent things. This is the word I mentioned earlier, the toeva, the abomination or the abhorrent. Really, almost like it's a word, it's a bad, negative thing, but especially, it seems like it's evil, but it's especially disgusting and revolting. And that is relevant here. Ha'ezrach v'hager hagar b'tochachem. And here's that that binary again. Neither the citizen, meaning one of you Israelites, nor the stranger who resides among you. The ger hagar b'tochachem. And in the Torah, a ger is not a convert. It's someone who's not Jewish, but lives among you. And neither you, the Israelite, nor the convert, or sorry, now I'm confusing myself, the non-Israelite, neither of you should do any of these things. Okay, and here's that word again. Ki et kol ha-toevot ha-el asu anshei ha-aretz asher lifneichem v'titma ha-aretz. Because all of those abhorrent things were done by the people who were in the land before you, and the land became defiled. Okay, and here's our key word again. Velotaki aretz etchem betamachem. So don't let the land disgorge you for defiling it. Kasher ka'a et hagoy asher lifneichem, as it disgorged the nation that came before you. All who do any of these abhorrent things, such person shall be cut off from their people. You shall keep my charge not to engage in any of the abhorrent practices, the toevot that were carried out before you, and you shall not defile yourselves through them. I am Hashem, your God. Okay. Now, let's just start by retranslating, right? The word there, disgorge, yak lahaki, right? Or just ki as the verb, or ke, as it is in the ke, I think it is in the ancient Hebrew, but I think in modern Hebrew, they just say ki. What, how might we, disgorge, spew out? What's another translation? What are we really talking about here? You know it, right? This is not one of those ones I need someone to raise in, but someone can say, yeah, what? Someone said it.
Vomit.
That's right, vomiting. A gross word, to be sure, vomiting. The land will vomit you out. The land will vomit you out. Now, I just, in some ways, I'm not sure, I'm calling for a meditation on just that image, and I'm not sure, you know, I need to go that much further. I want us to just think about what it means for the land, that metaphor. That the land, which will obviously, it's a metaphor because the land will not in fact vomit you out. But let me just prove for a minute that word means what someone just said it means. And just give you a couple of other examples so you know that I'm not just playing loose with the language here or playing gross with the language, so to speak. Here are some classic examples of its use in elsewhere in the Hebrew Bible, elsewhere in Tanakh. Here it is in Proverbs. This is a famous line. Kekelev shav el keo, just like a dog returns to its vomit. And those of us who have pets know that animals sometimes grossly do this. Ksil shone be'ivalto. So too does an idiot repeat his folly. Okay, so that's definitely vomit, right? Because that's a dog, you know, that's what a dog, like in the context, that's clearly vomit. And so vomit is something that no thinking person would want anything to do with, right? Would never go back to. It's not just that you disgorged it. It's that you don't want to look at it or see it again unless you're an idiot. Okay, so that's an interesting context. And here's just another, and maybe more directly relevant to our imagining today. We're really going to have to use our imaginations today. This is from the book of Jonah, Vayomer Hashem Ladag. God commanded the big fish, the whale, Vayake et Yonah el Hayabasha, and it vomited Jonah out. It disgorged. In that case, maybe disgorge would be a better translation, but that, you know, it puked Jonah up onto the shore. Okay. All right. So then again, the language that we're looking here, and now let's just retranslate it so that we're really like talking in this gross way. I have to edit this. Hold on. About not just disgorging, but vomited out, and that is very strong language. So I want to take some time to think about why the Torah is using this language, and what the connotation, what does it mean, especially since it's a threat to, so to speak, us, really, to the Israelites. Then be careful, because the land will vomit you out if you do any of these things. The word vomit, I feel funny teaching about it, but the word vomit, it's used there in Proverbs, it's used there in the book of Jonah, it's not used anywhere else in the Torah, except for one more time in Leviticus, in the middle of the curses, when it says the same thing: be careful and don't do these abominations, or else the land will vomit you up. Okay. I soon want to just hear your reflections on the metaphor, but I want to say one more thing before I do, which is just to name some of the abominations, and in doing so, to say, now the word abomination or disgusting thing feels relevant, because it's something you might throw up, something that would disgust you. Okay, what have those abominations been? They are nothing like, you know, current events. They are different kinds of abominations, and they fall so far. We could do another class on what constitutes an abomination, but so far the co-holiness code, such as it is, has been dealing with sexual prohibitions. That's what's come most recently, and some of you will probably associate even the English word with the sexual prohibitions against homosexuality. That obviously is an ethic that we are in the midst of, you know, reckoning with in the Torah. So I'm not going to focus on that today, but I will name another abomination that is that we can more easily agree on today, which is bestiality, but also all kinds of incest and, you know, sexual practices that the Torah forbids. Those are one category of abomination. Interestingly, in the midst of those is a commandment not to offer your child to be sacrificed to Molech. And so it's sexual prohibitions, but it's also somehow interwoven idolatrous practices. And here I don't just mean idolatry. I mean disgusting idolatry, right? Maybe there's a difference between worshiping a foreign god and offering your kid up to a foreign god. And then the other thing that is mentioned in this chapter is, and the previous one, is eating living things or drinking blood. Okay, so that there's very visceral. That's even eating language, eating living things, which has been prohibited since the days of Noah. But apparently these sorts of things, bestiality, incest, drinking blood, I mean, we're describing kind of a horror show here, and sacrificing children. These are the sorts of things that that was done in the land before you. And if you do them, the land will throw you up, barf you out, right? All the slang words for it. Okay, so let me just stop here and just think, I guess I just want to, let's turn the metaphor over a little bit and think about why the Torah chooses a word that it doesn't use very often to think about this particular phenomenon of what has been done in the land and what you should not be doing in the land, lest the land get sick to its stomach and disgorge you, right? Why is that the metaphor? I mean, we have one other reference point, which is that Jonah was thrown up. And that one happened at God's command. But here, it's not clear. Is it God's? It's God is explaining, but the land will do the throwing up. Okay, so does anyone want to speak to the nature of that metaphor? Just of why choosing that image as opposed to the land will abandon you, the land will kick you out, the land will swallow you up. How about that one? Like evil people in the book of Numbers are swallowed up by the land. Why would the land spit you out instead of consume you there? Okay, so let's start with Jory.
Hi, David.
Jory, who I met in Los Gatos, but who grew up in Oakland just like I did. So a native, a kinsperson of mine. Yeah, please, Jory.
I'm just have this image of the Dust Bowl running through my head, and how, you know, the Dust Bowl was, a lot of it was created by humans, and then you could not exist there anymore. It spit you out. People had to leave.
Great. That's great. That is a right. We're doing a little bit poetics here when we're thinking about imagery, and that is a great first poetic pass at this image, which is, okay, it's a metaphor for something. The land's not actually, like, you know, emitting vomit. It's a metaphor for, you know, the state of desolation in the case of the Dust Bowl, or destitution in the case of the Torah is describing, that is just so wretched that you'll eventually leave the land. You can't stay there. It will react in such a way that you will do the vomiting for the land. You will take yourself out of the land. Okay, good. Let's hear some other thoughts. Alice? Here, I'm going to ask you to unmute if you're having trouble here.
Right. Just trying to get rid of the hand. Okay. Yeah, so I'm kind of hung up on a question that I don't think goes anywhere. And you touched on it by mentioning swallowing the land. Why doesn't the land swallow you? It seems like for the land to throw you up, it should have eaten you first. And that made me think of where they say that, I think the Mechagalim, the spies say, this is, you don't want to go there. This is a land that eats its inhabitants. And so eating the inhabitants isn't good. Throwing them up is even worse. But I don't know if that really goes anywhere. Maybe you just have to sort of like skim over the idea that if the land didn't throw you up, it would have just eaten you forever.
That's so really excellent. That's really, really excellent. It's really, first of all, just let's take the metaphor seriously. If it throw you up, then you were inside of the land, which is a strange idea and beautiful connection. The spies who went to the land described it as Eretz Ochelet et Yosheveha, a land that consumes its inhabitants. Mm-hmm. That's a whole other metaphor to think about. What does it mean to be consumed by the land, in the belly of the land? And then, right, and then Alice asks us to consider that as the counterpart to the land that then, like, mm-hmm. cannot digest you. Mm-hmm. Bob, what do you think?
This may be too horrible, but I'm going to go here anyway. In the ancient concept that Hashem is the masculine figure and the earth is feminine, was this maybe morning sickness?
That's interesting. Right. That's interesting. I mean, that is, you're right that you're like, you're, that's a very specific derivation. So I too am a little like hesitant to go there, but I do think that the framing that you gave to get there is important to keep in mind, right? The land is a feminine entity, maybe more so in an ancient, like certainly grammatically, but maybe more so in an ancient worldview. But notably, I think the land is distinct as an entity from God. The land seems to have like a personality, maybe a different gender than God, and certainly a different being than God. And that relationship is not just a Kabbalistic spin. It is important because we've seen God and the land work in partnership before, right? When have God and the land gotten together to do something? Well, when God made us out of the Adama, out of the ground. And Nachmanides there in particular has a very beautiful reading of a very strange line there where it says, actually the line comes before, but the line is Nase Adam, let us make man. And then the Nachmanides explains that with the idea that comes later that God and the land get together to make a person. We are made of earthy Adama stuff. That's why we're called Adam. And we're made of divine breath. So that like kind of partnership, the God working and the land working to deal with us, I think it is really, that is really relevant. So we can think now about what might it mean if God is in partnership with the land and God says, hey, by the way, these people are going to live here and great, but then the land doesn't like us, those, you know, the way it's being treated, the things that are happening on it, or God doesn't and the land is working with God. All of that is really interesting thinking. And to all of that, I will just add, I was thinking in the along the lines that Bob just was, and I want to just I want to bring another text that again for further context that just it illustrates the kind of agency that Bob is talking about with the land. When in Genesis God said, and this is interesting language, tadsheh ha'aretz deshe, let the earth sprout vegetations, and the earth did so. Vatotzeh ha'aretz deshe. Now there's a partnership that's like, is the land doing it or is God doing it? And not only that, but a few verses later, God said, Totseh ha'aresh nefesh chaya lemina, let the earth bring forth life, right? And that's what Nachmanides is talking about. The earth is a partner in bringing life, right? In creating life. Now, we don't grow out of the earth the way that the grass does, but there again is a metaphor. It's as if we grow up out of the earth. We come from the earth and we go back to the earth. So all of that thinking of the land as an independent agent that may or may not be working with God, but has its own being and agency, that's all worth thinking about. All right, let's continue with these really great interpretations so far. Leah Matsui.
Okay. The land is also in partnership with being appalled. We see this in Genesis when Cain kills Abel. The earth, the blood of Abel goes into the earth and the earth cries out. I think there's reference to the mouth of the earth, just cannot handle this. I think it's from there. The earth is already saying no and spitting things out.
Good, good. Now that is a reference point that, you know, here we are. I said at the outset, this image makes me think about, you know, what it means to stay in the land and what it means to be removed from the land. And our word for that, by the way, is exile. Like what we're talking about right now is exile. When you are vomited out of land, you go into exile. So far. And we're talking about the disgusting things, you know, like, ugh, that makes me throw up to think of a kid offered to a foreign god or to drink blood. But speaking of blood, Leah's right that another moment of the land's, it's the blood that crawls out, you know, the blood of your brother cries out to me from the ground, right? But there's like the land is defiled also by the spilling of blood. By the spill, and those things are they seem very morally different, drinking blood and then like killing someone. But there's something about the improper use or spreading of blood, of life, of this thing that came up out of the ground that also would horrify the land, horrify God. Okay. And by the way, what is Cain's punishment when Cain has defiled the land in that way? Is to be na'avanad ba'aretz, to be someone who cannot dwell in the land, but has to wander constantly because he's defiled the land. Okay, so the connection lines that Leah is drawing right now are I think very very important. We're talking about like the land vomiting you out for ostensibly moral reasons, though all of those moral reasons are given in the language of more visceral, like I don't like that, disgusting, and. So the question is this, and I think that's brilliant the way you put it, that there's like God assigning a kind of naturalistic, it's inevitable. This is just the way the land is. The land cannot bear your gross foods or your gross sex, you know? But who's deciding what's gross food and what's gross sex? So there are various ways to read that. I won't come down on any one side, but we could say that, yes, that's the metaphysics here. The land has the holy land, and it has its own rules, and it exists in it, and it just needs things that other lands don't need. We could say on the other end of that kind of literalism, we could say no. The imagery is imagining you to think of it as a natural process, but it's really a metaphor for, you know, what will, you know, what will happen to you if you behave in a way that is destructive and immoral, and eventually there are consequences to that kind of behavior. So it's a very kind of, it's a much looser reality than the specifics of the metaphor. But I those are just possibilities, and I like the reflection that you offered, which is that there's a kind of, why does there's a, you could offer a critique here. Like, why doesn't God just say, I decided I don't like these things. I'm God. I will kick people out. I have rules, you know, you may not like them, but that's the way it is. No. What am I going to do? The land just cannot bear this. It's the land's fault. And there is a little bit of a passing of the buck there that I think is interesting. So let's just hold that tension, because I think that's worth looking at. On the note of the land, so here are a couple of commentators, and I think that they as is typical of them, Rashi and the Ibn Ezra are two most storied commentators, medieval commentators. Rashi is known for a more essentialist, metaphysically like vibrant, kind of fantastic interpretation, and the Ibn Ezra is known for a much more naturalistic, straightforward interpretation. So that will be reflected in the way that they interpret this scene. And Rashi, 11th century French commentator, Rashi indeed thinks that this land is special. And it has its a unique sensitivity. So Rashi's willing to, as we were just saying, maybe pass the buck to the land. Rashi says that the land not vomit you out. Mashal, this is a parable. It's a metaphor. Leven melech shehechilo davar ma'us. This is the case of a prince, the son of a king. In other words, says this translation, I didn't retranslate it, so i.e. a sensitive, refined person. That's the way they're reading the son of a king. We sometimes refer to ourselves as like, we're the children of a king, God is the king. But here the land is the prince or princess, we really should say, right? Since it's feminine, whom one gives a disgusting thing to eat, which She cannot retain on her stomach. I'm going with the land being feminine here, but vomits it out. Thus, Eretz Yisrael is unable to retain sinners on its soil. Eina mekayemet ovrei avera. It cannot sustain them. Okay, so that's interesting because, first of all, it does assign the sensitivity and the unique sensitivity of the land to certain disgusting acts. Again, what we're defining as disgusting is another class, so we'll hold that in. And yes, I admit that I'm not a great fan of some of the gender laws in the previous chapter, so I didn't like go deeply into them, but I'm a fan of some others. So like, you know, like, so I can kind of like relate to the concept, but I just want to say that Rashi's interpretation there is interesting because yes, he assigns that agency to the land, but it isn't a land that is strong and like, oh, I've had enough of these people, right? The land doesn't decide I cast you out. That's God talking in that language. The land is sensitive, right? She's just a delicate prince, the princess and the pea, right? And she's just grossed out and she can't help it. So that's an interesting thing that the land is not higher and more powerful than us, but actually the land is sensitive. And we ought to be careful about what we do in the land because it's delicate. And we might upset its delicate constitution. That's an interesting way, I think, to think about Eretz Yisrael, is that she just can't handle blood. She can't handle a child sacrifice. She can't handle maybe violence, you know, if we take it back to Cain and Abel. So, yeah. Okay. And then I'll give you the Ibn Ezra, who has, as I said, a much more kind of naturalistic approach and just describes the metaphor by saying the land vomited out her inhabitants. Whatever a person regurgitates is despised in his eyes and he will not take it back. So thinking just about vomit, right? And remember what we said about the dog does return to its vomit. Surely the Ibn Ezra has that in mind when he says, but a person does not go back to his vomit. It's disgusting. And you're not going to like take it back in ever. That's not what you do with vomit. And it's all very gross, but it's also very devastating. I mean, that the Ibn Ezra's implication there is think about vomit. Once you're out, you're out. So be careful. Be careful. Now, the Torah never returns to, or the Tanakh never returns to, and so the land did vomit the Israelites out, even though we left. So what to do with this metaphor, I don't know, but the way the Ibn Ezra phrases is be careful, the land may vomit you out and you will become the abomination. You will become so disgusting, the land doesn't want to go back to you ever again. Okay. So there's a couple of, we've heard a lot of really thoughtful interpretations from you all. And here's a couple from our sages. Let's see if we have time for a couple more. Stan?
I have a little problem with this. We go from the land with digestive issues to the very next parsha, and the very next line is, I am holy, you shall be holy. And then we go through a lot of very relatable commandments for us in the very next parsha. Since we divided the Torah into parsha yod, the Torah just keeps running through. And so my question is there a nexus between the next line about holiness right after the vomiting of the land? So I'm a little troubled by that.
Yeah, thank you, Stan. That's great. That's a great connection to make. So let's do that right now before we close. And I have some thoughts, but I would also welcome thoughts. But here's what Stan's talking about. I said we were in the middle of the, so to speak, holiness code. That's what what it's referred to in academic Jewish studies, because laws start in chapter 17, but it isn't until chapter 19 that we get what I think of as the holiness code, which is Parshat Kedoshim. Let's see how long this takes to load. Loading. Okay, here we are. So here's the land that became defiled, right? And then boom, as Stan says, then Parshat Kedoshim, which begins with this famous phrase, Kedoshim to you, Kedosha ani Adonai Elohechem. You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. And what does that mean? What does it mean to be holy? What does it mean to that law would make you holy. That's that's we'll talk about that more next week. But there are various answers to that. And I guess just in response to Stan's question, one of the answers that I like is, again, I think this is Nachmanides, who I quoted just earlier, who says that being holy, what does it mean to be holy? It means going milifnim reshut hadin, going beyond the letter of the law, or beyond the domain of the law. And Nachmanides says this very famously and very strikingly. He says, it's possible to be a navel birshut haTorah, a disgusting person, still within the bounds of the Torah. You can justify your actions and say, oh no, it's permitted, it's permitted, it's permitted, it's permitted. But he gives the example of someone just lying in bed like all day eating chicken and having sex and just like satisfying their own desires and doing nothing really for good in the world. And that person is not violating any law, but they're not holy because they don't go beyond the letter of the law. And all of that is to say, maybe, that these laws that are to come, some of which are very natural laws that you would expect, like don't steal from each other, but some of them are special and strange and unique, like, you know, not mixing wool and linen, and, you know, some of the strange commands that we consider hukim, or the things that make us holy. And maybe the idea then is, for this land, you have to go beyond the letter of the law. You could say this is technically allowed. You could say, well, you know, other nations do this, but that's not the way it is with this land. It's true. You could live in another part of, again, this is in the deep metaphysics of the Torah and a certain strain of its interpretation. I'm not asking everyone to accept this, but one way to take this is to say, this land requires you to go beyond the letter of the law. This land requires you to be holy, not just legal. And if not, the land's not interested in just, you know. So now that's a complicated thing to say, because in this tradition, when then we start to legislate, what is beyond the letter of law? What makes you holy? So that's a little funny. But just to take the idea that you have to behave not just well in this land, but better than you would behave in another land. And that's worth thinking about as well. All right, one last comment from Payam.
Thinking about the reciprocal of this in a modern context, when Rashi is writing this, they've been expelled. And so he's just saying they're all sinners. But what does it mean when we're living in the land of Israel and we're not expelled? Does that mean everything we're doing is right and holy? I mean, I think that's the danger of a passage like this, when you're actually living in the land and it hasn't vomited you out.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I think, you know, that's why I'm so afraid of direct application, because it seems like you could spin this in any number of ways, and who's really, you know, being, who are the Canaanites here, and who's really being like forced out, and, you know, who belongs in the, like, I don't want to go there, but I do think that your question is important, because I think, you know, I think one thing that this image brings to our communal reflection on this very difficult time, this very difficult situation, this very difficult war, is whatever else we think of other nations, the Torah is clear that, you know, we have to be careful ourselves, how we act in this land, because it doesn't belong to us, you know? And I hate that. I hate that. That's one thing I will say about Israel. It doesn't belong to us. It doesn't belong to the Palestinians. It doesn't belong to anyone. It belongs to God. It belongs to God. And maybe in this image, it actually maybe doesn't even belong to God. It has its own being. And so, like, this image, if nothing else, should remind us, like, what's happening at this current moment, I hesitate to apply. But it should at least remind us that we should be careful, because we are not guaranteed eternal dwelling on the land. In fact, we have not had it for most of our history, right? The land has the potential to kick us out independent of any other conflict, any other person, any other, a question of how we live in the land. That's the Torah's theology. And that in itself is, I think, worth taking with us to remember what it means to disturb the sensitive nature of this land. Okay. Yeah. I think that's all the time we have. And I wish us a time of peace and a land that is that feels at peace, a land that feels healthy and not sick as it must feel at this moment. Okay, love you all. See you all next week.